That was the story of the visionary businessman who laid the foundations for the modern Manchester United, the man who saved the club twice, the man who helped Walter Crickmer, the secretary, to create Manchester United's academy, who restored Old Trafford to greatness and restored Manchester United to greatness and appointed and trusted a fresh-faced Matt Busby after the Second World War. That was the story of James W. Gibson on United through time. And I'm delighted to say, for a first in the podcast history, we're having a reaction episode. And I've got a fantastic guest to join us while we do so in Wayne Barton, author of a countless number of United books. Wayne, do you have the number off the top of your head?
I think it's 21 or 22.
21.
It's not quite countless just yet, but my old age will probably make it countless at some point.
More than Manchester United titles. It's impressive. Most recent ones, you helped René Meulensteen to write the wonderfully titled United Sir Alex and Me. Obviously, Duncan Edwards and Jimmy Murphy are probably... Are they the two... That and True Genius, are they the two kind of biggest for you?
I would say those three are, maybe it's like recency thing as well, because they're the most recent ones. The subjects help as well, you know, doing a book about George Best. And thankfully, most people don't think I've got it wrong. Do you know what I mean? You do take on a precious subject like him and Duncan and Jimmy, to be fair, and to make sure that, you know, like the feedback was all right for it. So I think that's helped a lot. So, yeah, I would probably go along with that. But, you know yourself, Harry, books are like babies. And they've all got their own special place. You know, like, the experience of working on them all has been special in its own right.
Yeah, and the Jimmy, Duncan Edwards and George Best are hardly names that need introducing. But for quite a long time, Jimmy Murphy's was one of those. And I think the reason I'm so passionate about James Gibson, and I know you are, and I know the late Ian Sterling was really passionate about this and used to lay flowers on behalf of the family at James Gibson's grave. And it's also why I'm passionate about Walter Crickmer and all the other characters in the book that I wrote, is because, like Jimmy Murphy, they are these unsung heroes in what they did for United. And would you agree that, similar to Murphy, James Gibson is absolutely that?
Yeah, there's no question to say that is the case. I mean, Gibson is one of, and you've said that yourself there, and obviously in your book you've covered it, where you talk about like the different individuals, and there are lots of different individuals who, let's get it right, the modern Manchester United, the identity of Manchester United is shaped by the idea of Matt Busby, and then secondarily Jimmy Murphy. If you know your history, you'll credit those two together. But the fact of the matter is that everything, rather one or two things that are particular to Busby and Murphy, but everything else about the club's identity precedes those two people. If you go digging, even like the style of play, like I said, the youth policy and everything like that, the working class roots, the even down to like little things like as silly as a star player and then workmanlike players in the side, all these kind of things, facets of the club's identity can be found before Busby and Murphy. And Gibson, yeah, absolutely, he's one of the biggest names when it comes to looking at the identity, because of how, first of all, he's benevolence, but second of all, his support financially and in time just as valuable in this case as money, to make sure that amount of time was invested into something that has become the bedrock of the club's identity. Time, again, is really the key asset, you know, that we're talking about, because who else, which other chairman, which other owner of a football club would dedicate 10 years at least to the sort of restoration and just say, like, you've got this amount of time to sort of go at it and establish something that we believe in. He's up there. If you did a Mount Rushmore of people whose faces were going to be on, you know, it's crucial to that.
The impossible question.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to answer it. I'm just saying that I would think he'd be on there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the kind of, obviously you don't necessarily need an argument to write a book about United's history, because it can just be entertaining and interesting. But I think that's kind of the reason I wrote mine, is, kind of annoys me a bit when our history stops, when we go back and it stops at 1945, and there's so much amazing stuff before then. And I do think you look at the kind of courage of Matt Busby to enter the European Cup against the wishes of the Football League after winning the title in the mid 50s. is preceded by the courage of Gibson to give him a 5-year contract rather than a 3-year contract to appoint him as manager when Liverpool only were offering him the assistant's job, thought he needed a bit more time. And then to say, yeah, eventually after Matt has a bit of an argument with him, to go, okay, we don't need to sign anyone. I believe in you. Just crack on with restoring Mujak to its greatness and then letting the babes come through. So that courage is there already. And I guess it's there in the 30s as well. And yeah, I think that's behind every great manager, as we're seeing in the modern day, where United probably don't have this at the moment. You need a great support. And I guess for Sir Alex, it was Sir Bobby Charlton a lot of the time in those early days. And for Matt Busby, it was Gibson.
Yeah, no, that's fair. But again, like, it does precede it. There's certain elements that Busby is credited with. And you wouldn't, it's a tricky field. And I know it takes someone, like, you know, you really have to be thorough and accurate with what you're doing, because the last thing, and I know that you're very, firstly, passionate and cautious with this yourself, is that you don't want to detract anything from Busby. That's not what you're doing, really. You're saying, you're embellishing, really, if anything. You're saying the Busby and Murphy story is just this amazing thing that it deserves all the accolades. What are you saying? You do go further. It's not detracting anything to say, look, actually, there are roots here that went before this. I mean, Gibson going against Scott Duncan, it was Duncan's wishes to sign Rowley because he'd seen him. And he brought him to the club and he became the club's, like, record goal scorer. And he was moved around in position. Johnny Carey was moved around in different positions. These things would become hallmark of what Busby and Murphy would do. You know, like their famous training ground thing would be to reposition loads of players to make them comfortable in different areas of the pitch. But this was going on before. Busby's team that he inherited was basically Cricketman's team, the one that won the 1948 Cup. And by extension, then it's Gibson's team as well, because he was the one who sort of put a lot of those building blocks into place. So, yeah, you would all. It's pushing it, because Busby deserves a lot of credit in what he did in sort of motivating those players into that pattern of football that he wanted and in adopting that. But it is very much Cricketman and Gibson's side as well that won the 48. And in essence of it being the club's, so many youth players were in that team that it was already the realisation of what they'd put in place. So that's there. You can't take that triumph away from them. As much as you give it to Busby and Murphy, which you would do, nobody would take that away. But it is important to say it is as much Cricketman's and Gibson's.
Yeah, I love the 1948 Cup final. And it's in the podcast on Gibson as well, where the players stop off at his house en route to the Manchester celebrations. It's just the most, it's like the most beautiful way for that, their project to end, and the most kind of symbolic way of that being the kind of end of Gibson and Cricketman's time of real influence on United. And that's where Busby and Murphy, they keep much of the team for 52 and the title win, but then dismantle it and go off and create the best team in English football scene. But it's such a beautiful kind of point of closure that Gibson, I love the fact that he was this kind of, he only really discovered United in his 50s, but it then became his kind of lifelong ambition to see United win something. And it's a very romantic story.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that I know you're not here for me to give you praise, and you specifically asked me not to do that. No, you didn't. one of the things that I really liked about the podcast and any piece of work that really delves into this kind of thing is having Alan Emblin on, because he tells these stories very well. Yeah. I've been lucky enough to speak to him on a number of occasions. And like the by extension of the story that you're saying, where the players come back and they take the trophy to Alan O, they kept the trophy at the house for a number of months after, because it was kept in a cupboard somewhere and they brought it out sometimes.
Yeah.
That's how much they loved that. That was like an indication of the success that they brought to the club. And I think what's the important thing that I'm referencing Alan Emblin about is because too often we can research these things, and you can find plenty of stuff online, and you can find all the stories online and in other good books that have been written. But you go to the heart of, you know, to these people who are closely connected as much as you can do, And then you find out the extra stories, the things that...
The nuggets.
The emotional... No, not even just the nuggets, but the emotional connection to it in a way that...
Yeah.
So it all develops your resonance and your connection to the club, but also hopefully you can tell that story as well in a way that you can't do without those people. They're crucial for that. The thing that I remember Alan telling me about James, about the introduction of the youth system, because I always felt the most fascinating thing to me about that was the... And you never really got, I never really felt like I was satisfied with an answer until I talked to Alan about it, was the idea of it being chicken and egg, you know, in so much as, I mean, was it a youth system born out of the idea of redeveloping to make money for the club, or was it to create a team that represented Manchester? And it was a little bit of both. I remember Alan telling me, but the idea was that he wanted to give the kids of Manchester something to aspire to, something to dream of. And this, obviously, it was pre-Second World War, but it was a message that was revolutionary because this was the ethos which the entire country would live by after the war. It became like you needed recreation, you needed something to aspire to that was outside the grayness of society. And that's what football represented. And obviously, you move on a generation and George Best is the physical incarnation of that and the swinging 60s and everything. But United were putting the building blocks in place to make that happen. So, I mean, he's predated Best's eminence by 30 years, but he, obviously everyone since then, Beckham, Rashford these days, they're all enjoying that spotlight which was put in place. I know Alan was very passionate on your podcast where he's talking about the entire Stretford infrastructure benefiting from
it.
And he's right on the wider point. He's absolutely right. But the significant insular point on Manchester United, the youth platform, creating something for youngsters to aspire to and to dream, was so poignant that, all right, it's great. It's the logical repercussions of the close-knit fabric of a team welded together and developing a pattern of play and understanding each other's patterns of movement and everything like that. It's all great secondary things that have been of massive benefit to United through the generations. But the simple prospect of a boy can dream is it's very romantic. And I love that he gave that to the club.
Yeah. And I love the fact it's the development of the academy is kind of, it follows the storyline so well. So Gibson's dream is a Manchester United made up of Manchester players, but then Bosby and Murphy take that and blossom it out. So then you get lads from Ashington and Dudley and then Belfast. And then in the 90s, Sir Alex comes. And first of all, he tasks Eric Harrison with kind of revitalizing, rejuvenating the youth system first in the Northwest, but then it blossoms out. And then in the late 90s, early 2000s, you start to get players from outside of the UK and Ireland as part of that, and that carries on and kind of accelerates throughout the 2000s, and you get Adnan Januzaj and Paul Pogba and those who didn't make it as well, like Mats Møller-Daly and Marnik Vermeil, etc. The latest example being Garnacho, and it kind of, that development of it is so wonderful. And when you talk to the academy coaches now, and especially to Nick Cox, the director of academy, that awareness of the philosophy and the innovation behind what Gibson did still plays a massive role in today's United. I think that's, you probably don't see it as much at first team level, but the fact the academy is so aware of its past is comforting as a fan, I think.
Yeah, I think it all blends into that bigger picture in first team level. It's just, it's more subliminal. It plays its part in when things are working. And when things are, I mean, when things aren't going so well, like they haven't done for the last generation, you say, well, they're the moments of resonance. They're the ones that matter most. Like when Rashford was having his really bad patch a couple of years ago and he scored the last minute winner against West Ham. And it was like one of the most popular goals of the season because he was like, could this be something different? So when Rashford was back on song last season, you're kind of like, all right, it has that resonance because of that. But then, It does. Obviously, it starts at the roots, and it's good. It is good that the people are aware of that, and that the current employees are aware of that. But again, it goes back to Busby and Murphy popularized this sort of branching out and taking Manchester to the world. But it goes back to Gibson and the idea that he was very, very subtly improving the infrastructure so people could come from further afield. Now, directly, that meant the old fans from Newton Heath could come to Old Trafford, but it was improving the infrastructure to say come from further afield. And obviously you go back to Magnell and Davies and the idea that they've built like a grand 100,000 arena. It's not there to just populate, you know, like just for Old Trafford. It's there for everyone to come and see. And
yeah.
Obviously, I mean, you go back further still. I mean, these were the days when, you know, United under Newman Heath, one of their first games was against the Canadians. They've always had this like metropolitan spirit. So I think, say, the early 50s was when they, and to be fair, Alan Emblin, when I quizzed him on this, didn't say that it was anything particular of Gibson's entrepreneurial spirit. But when the club started going to America under Busby's vision to sort of conquer the world and take United to the world, it is nonetheless an extension of the natural direction of the way that the club was going. So this idea that they're like a global entity now where all these players can come from anywhere and it still feels like it's the same kind of thing. It's a homogenous thing that still feels like it's a natural development and arm of itself is an incredible thing to witness, really, considering that we're in a day and age when, you know, technology makes everything else so accessible, but the club have embraced that and it still feels like a natural part, considering, you know, critical people can be of everything to do with a club, that this is a natural thing is really, really beautiful. And you can't discount, again, Gibson's role in that.
Yeah, I love the kind of idea that Gibson had all of this vision and ambition. And in Busby, he found arguably someone who had it to an even greater extent. And then so Busby's the person who takes, because there's a possibility that even with the great work that Gibson and Crickman did, United would have become a good side in English football history who were challenging for titles and did things well. But much like Everton at the time or Wolves at the time, they were a very well-run club who would have some success. But it needed Busby and Murphy to take it to a completely different level that people hadn't seen before. But yeah, I love the kind of the way that Busby takes on the mantle and just does creates what we all know as the modern Manchester United. The final thing we should talk about, and you speak about maintaining that identity. And I think this is something that I often talk about. Athletic Club from Bilbao are probably the best example in elite football of being able to keep that core identity, but it is something that United do very well too, but probably could do better. And we're speaking at a time where there's a new co-owner of the club, and you hope that the first kind of weeks and months of Sir Jim Ratcliffe's kind of era of Manchester United will involve working out what United's identity is and then progressing onwards from that. But the similarities between Gibson and Ratcliffe, when I listen back to the episode and when I look through my notes and my scripts, it's the things that Gibson, their mission statements are so similar. It's remarkable.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's impossible. If you've studied that period of United's history, as you have, it's impossible not to be startled by the comparison. If only for the fact that for the first time in a century, and by the way, I say this as someone who's been lucky enough to meet and work with Martin Edwards on multiple occasions, but this is the first, I don't think even he would mind me saying that it's the first time in almost a century where you've had pure benevolence from an ownership standpoint, where money's just going to be funneled in to the club with no expectation of anything back. And there's no one alive really who can bear witness to what Gibson did and how it physically impacted, you know, the day-to-day operations at United. There are people who can talk about the post-war stuff, but no one really alive to talk about how it really impacted United at the time, apart from, obviously, Alan Emblin, who can give you a sort of first-hand reference of that, which is why his contribution to everything Manchester United is so significant, especially now. But yeah, I mean, the comparisons to Ratcliffe are just the way that he talks about, you know, wanting United to move to a new arena and everything, or like a Wembley of the North. You might not like the catchphrase and stuff like that, but the prominent point there is when people talk about what United's tradition and cultural history is, so much of it is attached to Old Trafford. But then again, they've got a history of outgrowing and moving on. Do you know, and Gibson supported that. If I'm pretty sure that if in the post-war era, if it had been more cost-effective to just rebuild somewhere else, they would have done that and they wouldn't have been in Old Trafford. It was just, I guess, it just made more sense to reinvest and rebuild what was there at the time and that sort of thing. So in terms of the way that he talks, it is, I mean, you can't get away from the fact that the one thing that he's doing that is different to Gibson. Gibson, you know, you have custodians and you have pioneers. Gibson was a pioneer. Ratcliffe is going to be more of a custodian. He's going to try and pioneer in the sense that we haven't seen something that way for a century, but he's still custodian, protecting and preserving the legacy that was created by Gibson, which I think really is a more fitting tribute to him in a way.
It's a nice thing. Yeah. He's just, when I look at the, you will have seen in the old newspaper archives, around kind of like December 20th, 21st, 1931, where Gibson finally get the directors finally say, right, we need you to come. And Gibson says how he's long been interested in United and he's at the head of it now. And if the public back him up, United won't fail. That's his guarantee. And then he talks about how he wants to make United one of the best teams in the country, wants to give a covered stand to the pop siders at Old Trafford. And, the same sentiment of restoring to success and facilities and infrastructure is exactly what Ratcliffe has come up with immediately. And ultimately, this is all underpinned by the fact actions are what matter rather than words. But at this stage, it does give you hope that it's also the circumstances surrounding their takeover. So the 10 years before Gibson is of underachieving of directors who didn't engage with the fans. And there were boycotts or attempted boycotts at Old Trafford. And we were often signing past it players who did perform occasionally and stopped United from getting relegated at times. But the circumstances before and the quotes are the same. And you think, can we hope for what we got in the 1930s, which was, it was slow and gradual and there were bad times, but United slowly progressing upwards. And by the time war comes around, it's an incredibly well-run club. And if war hadn't intervened, who knows what would have happened?
No, yeah, I think that's fair. And I think the apart from the facts, which you just said there, the historical facts, which bear fruit in any sort of deeper analysis, there is that romance of fate and destiny that's associated with United so strongly. And yeah, and other people can say that about their own football clubs. But there is everything, there's a thread to United's history that goes through every part, every facet of its identity, which we've covered very briefly in this chat. But to go through things like they won the European Cup on Matt Busby's birthday. You know what I mean? Things like that. There are things, Ryan Giggs breaking the appearance record, winning a European Cup, all those kind of things. Football cyclical, things repeat. Manchester United's history is cyclical, things repeat. So obviously, it's an obvious thing to then go, we could hope that something great is happening again because you've got the same set of circumstances are put in place. So there's optimism anyway, but associated with the fact that it's closely attached to what the culture of the club is, then it would make a supporter like you and I, who's gone to the trouble of listening to the great podcast that you did, or making it like you did, but other people who listen to it or do any kind of research on James Gibson, would make them understand that there's something deeper at play that means more, not necessarily more in the football society, but more to us as a United supporter. There's something good to get behind.
What a fantastic note to end on. Wayne, thank you very much for coming on United Through Time and reflecting on an inspirational figure in the club's history, James Gibson.